From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Last month, pro-democracy demonstrators in Thailand forced out that country's self-appointed prime minister. And in several other Southeast Asian countries, democracy has taken a fragile hold. On today's Fresh Air, we look at the rise of democracy in Southeast Asia with Sydney Jones, executive director of the human rights group Asia Watch. Also, we talk to the team behind the film Poison Ivy, Kat Shea and Andy Rubin. Their new film has been described as everything from laughingly bad to brilliant and powerfully disturbing. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews new comeback albums by Ann Peebles and Otis Clay. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush plans to launch an environmental offensive as he prepares to attend the Earth Summit in Rio. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
George Bush vowed to be the environmental president, but he's been portrayed lately as more of an environmental villain, opposing the biodiversity treaty at the Earth Summit and forcing the watering down of an agreement on global warming. So now the administration is undertaking a public relations campaign to polish its tarnished environmental image. It's issued a glossy magazine complete with color photos and diagrams charting American environmental expenditures. As the president leaves for Rio tomorrow morning, he'll make what his spokesman calls fairly aggressive remarks, setting out the hard truths about environmental protection. The president speaks in Rio on Friday. There, his spokesman says, Mr. Bush will praise the U.S. environmental record as a model for the world. And despite the criticism of administration policies in Rio, the spokesman says the president expects a warm reception at the summit. This is Brian Naylor at the White House.
The Pentagon says that one American soldier was killed and another was injured today in a drive-by shooting in Panama. The U.S. soldiers were attacked by three men armed with assault rifles on a road outside Panama City. The shooting followed 2 days of demonstrations against tomorrow's visit by President Bush. At the White House, the president told reporters, "Any time an American serviceman is hurt, that's bad. Killed is worse." The names of the soldiers involved were withheld pending notification of their families. The U.S. Army has begun a new program that's supposed to ensure America never again buries the body of an unknown soldier, NPR's Dan Charles reports.
Starting today, the Army will take samples of blood and saliva from every new recruit and keep them on file. If the soldier is later lost in battle or in a plane crash, the Army will retrieve these samples and try to match them with tissue from unidentified bodies found at the scene, using tests on each body's unique pattern of genetic material, or DNA. Eventually, the military's DNA bank will cover more than 3 million people, making it the largest collection of biological samples anywhere that's available for genetic testing. Critics of the Army's program, such as the Council for Responsible Genetics in Cambridge, Massachusetts, say that it will encourage widespread use of genetic testing in law enforcement or by employers and insurance companies, violating people's rights to privacy. In Washington, this is Dan Charles reporting.
Stock prices took another steep slide today on Wall Street as investors waited for end-of-the-week reports on retail sales and wholesale and consumer prices. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost nearly 27 points to close at 3,343. Declines led advances by almost 2-to-1 in heavy trading of about 206 million shares. This is NPR News. There were more signs of trouble this week for the plan to tighten the political and economic unity of the European community. Yesterday, Germany, France, and Britain said that the budget for the unity plan was too expensive. EC President Jacques Delors is asking for an increase of more than 31% in the community's budget by 1997. Lebanese security sources report that Israeli jets bombed Palestinian bases in South Lebanon today. 4 guerrillas were wounded in the incident. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports.
It was the 12th Israeli air raid in 3 weeks and the second Israeli attack today. In an earlier attack, Israel TV reported that Israeli helicopters bombed a squad of Palestinian guerrillas who were on their way to attack Israeli soldiers or soldiers of the Israel-backed South Lebanon Army. Two guerrillas were reported injured in that attack. The Israeli air raid came after guerrillas from the Muslim fundamentalist Hezbollah attacked a South Lebanon Army outpost, injuring one soldier seriously. It was the first attack by Hezbollah since Iranian Foreign Minister Ali Akbar Velayati visited Lebanon last week. Publicly, Velayati said Iran will continue to support Hezbollah, but privately, many in Israel believed he asked Hezbollah to restrain themselves from attacks on Israel. For the past 3 weeks, there have been clashes between Israel and Hezbollah in South Lebanon. At least 27 people have been killed and 73 injured. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
The American Heart Association said today that secondhand cigarette smoke should be treated as an environmental toxin and should be banned from homes, workplaces, and all public areas. The group released a paper summarizing what its authors said was an overwhelming amount of evidence that exposure to the smoke of others increases a person's chances of getting lung cancer or heart disease. The Heart Association dismissed claims by the American Tobacco Institute that there's no clear evidence linking environmental tobacco smoke with heart and lung problems. I'm Corey Flintoff, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This appears to be a time of change in Southeast Asia. Thailand's pro-democracy movement forced the ouster of Prime Minister Suchinda, a former general who had never been elected. In the Philippines, there was a free and fair presidential election for the first time in 23 years. The UN is overseeing peace accords in Cambodia. We invited Sidney Jones to talk with us about how much progress is being made in the direction of democracy in the region of Southeast Asia. Jones is the executive director of Asia Watch, which is part of the group Human Rights Watch. She lived in Indonesia for 4 years, although now she is blacklisted and banned from returning. She's a former staff member of Amnesty International. I spoke with her this morning before the announcement that phase two of the Cambodian peace talks would proceed without the Khmer Rouge. I asked her first about the news from Thailand this morning that a new prime minister had been appointed.
The person who was chosen is a man named Anand, who's interesting because he's very respected. He was the person who was appointed prime minister after the military coup in February 1991, and he surprised everybody by not only being absolutely incorrupt and leading one of the most honest governments Thailand's ever had, but also in standing up to the military. The problem with him is that he's not elected, and this whole democracy movement was to push for more democracy, more elected officials. And the Thai parliament passed an amendment today that every prime minister from now on has to be an elected official. So it's clear that his position is only an interim one.
So this new constitutional amendment says that the prime minister has to be elected. Do you know when those elections will take place?
It's not clear. It's also not clear how long Anand will stay in power. Some people say that as soon as the House takes its seat, because since the March 22nd election, the newly elected House hasn't met, that it should be dissolved and new elections called. There are other people that say that Anand should serve for a period of about 6 months. So it's not at all clear, and I think people are still worried about the volatility of the situation.
Now, the pro-democracy movement in Thailand was really led by the middle class, as I understand it. Is there a growing middle class in Thailand?
Not only is there a growing middle class in Thailand, there's a growing middle class throughout Southeast Asia. And I think that's been the most important factor in pressing for democratic change throughout the region. There used to be this assumption that because the countries were growing economically and because more and more people were prospering, that what their real concern was for the money to keep coming in, and they weren't particularly interested in democratic change. And I think one of the most important lessons of the Thai events is that that's a completely false assumption. The more people do grow wealthy or at least better off than they were before, the more they want to stay in their own government. And I think that's what the democracy movement was all about.
Several of the countries in Southeast Asia have been undergoing something of an economic boom. But on the other hand, the countries have been under authoritarian control. And a lot of people are saying it's the authoritarian control that has made the economic boom possible because everything's so tightly regulated. I'd like you to connect that to the rise of the middle class.
Well, I think that it's true that many of the countries in Southeast Asia have been undergoing an economic boom, and there are some of these countries that are regarded as being the next South Korea's or the next Taiwan's. And to some degree, it probably has been a long period of relative stability that's made that growth possible. But there comes a time when it becomes counterproductive to keep the controls in place. And one of the things you've seen after the Thai movement is that investors are getting very wary of investing in Thailand because of the possibility of political instability. You even had stories of Thai bankers and other people who had, in fact, benefited from the period of economic growth deliberately selling shares on the Thai stock exchange to make the stock market fall and discourage investors, figuring that economic pressure on the government might be the only way of really exerting pressure to change the government and get rid of Prime Minister Suchinda. So there has been a linkage between the economic growth and demand for democratic change. I think probably at one point there was a connection between the period of authoritarianism, if you like, and the benefits that the middle class received. But there's no question that the middle class and the growth of the middle class are responsible for some of what we see now in the region.
My guest is Sydney Jones. She's the executive director of Asia Watch, which is a human rights group. You know, there's an argument that goes that Asians don't want Western-style democracy because it could compromise their economic gains. I think you've addressed that. The other argument goes that Asians don't want Western-style democracy because of cultural differences. They've been brought up respecting authority, valuing consensus, accepting their position in life. What do you think of that?
I think that that argument is often used as a pretext for keeping on dealing with authoritarian leaders. I'm not sure it's true. I think it is true that it's not necessarily the case that even members of the Asian pro-democracy movements want a wholesale import of Western institutions. They don't necessarily want to have a two-house parliament or multi-party systems the way the European countries have them. But there is certainly a demand for basic freedom of association, freedom of expression. They don't want to be thrown in prison every time they criticize the government. I think the quest for those kinds of freedoms is very clear and growing throughout the region. So the idea that Asians are somehow comfortable with an authoritarian leadership, I think is nonsense now.
What role would you like to see the United States and other Western countries play in ensuring human rights in countries of Southeast Asia or in encouraging pro-democracy movements?
I think the United States has basically played a much too soft-spoken role and in some cases a directly counterproductive role in the region. If you look at testimonies in Congress, for example, by members of the State Department on Southeast Asia, they emphasize the growing trade and investment between the United States and the region. They emphasize the communication links. They emphasize the cooperation that Southeast Asia gave to U.S. efforts in the Gulf War. There's not really a concern for the mistreatment of citizens of these countries by their own governments. And it's as though most of the time the United States would prefer to shove the human rights concerns under the table and pretend they're not there while trade and investment and business increases. I think this is a wildly misguided policy because I think in the long run it'll hurt business, it'll hurt investment, and it will hurt trade if the end result of ignoring human rights abuses is to create more instability in these countries.
I'm going to ask you to help us interpret some of the recent changes in some of the countries of Southeast Asia. Let's start with Cambodia, where the UN is overseeing a peace plan. Now, the Khmer Rouge just seceded from phase two of this peace plan. They said they won't participate in the second phase of the peace accord, which calls for the containment and disarmament of most soldiers. Why did they pull out?
They pulled out ostensibly because they accused the United Nations of not living up to its part of the agreement of verifying the withdrawal from Cambodia of Vietnamese military advisors. One part of the peace agreement initially is signed in Paris was that there would be verification of the withdrawal of all foreign military elements and advisors. The Khmer Rouge have made great political capital inside Cambodia of saying that the government is still under the control of the Vietnamese, that there's still many Vietnamese advisors. This is from the period in 1979 when Vietnam invaded Cambodia and basically throughout the Khmer Rouge. So they're using this as a pretext for not going along with the UN accords and the demobilization and disarmament stage. I must say that nobody really expected the Khmer Rouge to go fully along with that plan anyway. Everybody believed the Khmer Rouge was still stockpiling arms, and even if they made pro forma efforts to turn in weapons, they really weren't going to be serious about it. But it's very, very disturbing and very dangerous that they've essentially called a halt to the peace process at this stage. And nobody's quite sure what to do next because the whole peace process is contingent on all four parties agreeing.
There were recently elections in the Philippines. Can you give us your analysis of the meaning of those elections?
The Philippines is a sad case because everybody held it up as a shining example of democracy after Mrs. Aquino returned to power or took power after the fall of Marcos in 1986. And instantly, there were all of these democratic institutions established. The Philippines Congress came back. There was freedom of the press. There still is freedom of the press. But the economy was in such a shambles that you got a resurgence of the kind of warlordism that's plagued Philippine politics for the last several decades. And in these elections, you had seven candidates running that covered the spectrum from Imelda Marcos at the bottom to an anti-corruption campaigner, Miriam Defensor Santiago, at the other end. And in between, you had old Marcos cronies like Cuanco, who's Cory Aquino's cousin. And you had the person who appears to have won the election, Fidel Ramos, who had been chief of staff of the armed forces under Mrs. Aquino in 1986 and then defense minister. And he is now probably going to become president, but with less than 30% of the vote. And this is a real problem because the Philippines has been plagued by political turmoil and disaffection within the various ranks and services of the military. There are many people that speculate that because he has such a low percentage of the vote that he may in fact face a coup attempt. And I think this is one thing we all have to wait and see.
I think the statistic is 65% of the population of the Philippines is below the poverty line. Do you think it's going to be more difficult for the Philippines to enjoy the economic growth of the more authoritarian countries of the region?
I think it's clear that it's almost the basket case of the ASEAN countries, of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, but it's not because it doesn't have an authoritarian government. If you think of the authoritarian government it had when Marcos was in power, and in power for more than 25 years, it was Marcos's authoritarian leadership and corruption on an unprecedented scale that led the Philippines directly into the economic problems it's facing now. So there's not necessarily a correlation between authoritarian rule and democracy and economic growth in this case. I think if the Philippines had had a democratic government in the 25 years preceding Mrs. Aquino, it might have had a much better economic situation than it has now.
Even under Aquino, your group Asia Watch was issuing reports about human rights abuses in the Philippines.
Yes, very much so. And in fact, we were very disappointed that there wasn't a better performance on the human rights side than there was under Mrs. Aquino's leadership. And part of the problem was an inability to control the military and basically giving the military a carte blanche to go after the communist insurgency, the New People's Army, without respecting the human rights of civilians who were living in areas where the NPA was operating. And even today, you have left-wing activists who are operating legally and above ground being targeted by gunmen who were working for the military in either an official or unofficial capacity. We issued a report on the official civilian militia that was set up by the army. And this is actually, interesting because Ramos, Fidel Ramos, who is now going to be president, was, first of all, the person probably responsible directly for setting up this civilian militia, which hasn't been under proper control by the military since it was initiated. But also, if you think about it, he was the person who led the Philippines Constabulary, which was one of the worst abusers of human rights under Marcos, and he led it for a long, long time without any real stigma being attached to him. If Reagan was a Teflon president in the United States, then Ramos was a Teflon general in the Philippines.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Sidney Jones. She's the executive director of Asia Watch, a human rights group. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about political and social change in the region of Southeast Asia. My guest is the executive director of Asia Watch, Sidney Jones. One of the things that all human rights groups try to do is really focus international attention on the human rights violations in the part of the world that they're watching. Now that the United States isn't involved in Vietnam, the attention of Americans isn't on Southeast Asia like it once was. Do you find it hard to get the word out about the violations that you're finding out about and to ignite interest about it?
That issue is probably the most frustrating one I have to deal with. It's as though Southeast Asia was utterly off the map as far as most Americans were concerned. You got a little attention to Thailand when the demonstration took place. It may have appeared for a couple of minutes on the evening news, and then it vanishes. You had this massacre in East Timor. You had a few minutes on the evening news. And again, you ask most Americans where East Timor is, and most people wouldn't know. And to try and get any kind of sustained pressure in a country which isn't a major security concern to the United States, in a country where there isn't a major exile population in the United States with any political clout, there are almost no Indonesians except for students in the United States. The Thais certainly aren't a political force. You don't have even Chinese Americans. Aren't the kind of political force that they could be given their numbers. So it is incredibly frustrating to try and get attention. And the only way to do it is to find a few members of Congress who are interested in an issue enough to push repeatedly to try and put pressure on the administration to look seriously at an issue. But you also realize how few correspondents there are in Southeast Asia. There are almost no foreign correspondents from the United States in Jakarta, for example, and the ones that are there aren't working for major U.S. newspapers or U.S. television channels.
Well, you know, in that respect, I bet that the cuts that so many newspapers and network news operations have faced, you know, the budget cuts and the layoffs have had a really bad effect on groups like yours because there's fewer reporters based in the countries that you're concerned about.
It's really a major headache, and you have a few reporters based in Bangkok. You have Mary Kay Magstad, who's wonderful for NPR, but there just isn't the kind of coverage in the United States, and the focus on domestic issues here and the kind of insularity of many Americans is a real problem for getting attention. One of the things that we're trying to do now is to get more attention to Japan and more attention from the Japanese government towards the countries in Southeast Asia to which the Japanese provide huge amounts of development aid. And there are Japanese correspondents in all of these countries. The question is how we can try and push for more attention to human rights issues within a country that, first of all, we don't know very well, and secondly, where the institutions that we would normally work through in the U.S. don't really exist. It's a real challenge, but I think there has been a major change on the part of the Japanese government toward taking human rights issues more seriously, particularly in the last 2 years.
The Earth Summit is happening now in Rio, and I'm sure that there are issues about the environment, indigenous populations, and economic development that are pivotal in what's happening now in Southeast Asia. Would you address that for?
I think the biggest environmental issue, which is very much related to the democracy movement in all of these countries, is the interrelationship between military economic interests and logging. You've got a lot of the world's rainforest in Southeast Asia, in Malaysia, in the Philippines, in Thailand, in Burma. And what you find is that one of the biggest sources of foreign exchange is the export of hardwoods, particularly teak, but other forms of wood as well. And in many countries, the military gets these timber concessions and goes into an area. And then not only do they displace indigenous people from the rainforest areas, but they also crack down on anybody that tries to protest against the loggers coming in. And it's a major problem throughout the region, not only environmentally in the sense that there's this depletion of the rainforest, but also in terms of abuse of environmental activists. So that we're increasingly turning to the Environmental Defense Fund and the Natural Resources Defense Council here to try and pool our resources and our efforts to try and get some attention to this issue. The environmental groups can work on the logging side and will work on defense of the activists and protecting their rights to freedom of expression and freedom of association and so on. But we do have to work together. It's been a very interesting development, and it's just over the last 2 years that we've seen the need to work so closely with the environmental groups.
You've been following human rights in Southeast Asia for, well, many years at this point, about a decade.
Mm.
Are there any real changes that you've seen in the types of human rights violations that are being reported?
I think there is one major change, which is that it used to be that all human rights organizations were concerned with the detention of political prisoners for their political beliefs. And this was the major human rights violation throughout the world. What we've seen now is a slight change. There still are certainly political prisoners, but for example, in Indonesia, where there used to be tens of thousands of prisoners accused of supporting the Communist Party in the 1960s, or hundreds and hundreds of East Timorese prisoners in jail in East Timor, which has now been annexed forcibly by Indonesia, you find a different kind of violation taking place now. Most of these countries know that the surest way to get international outrage and international pressure is to keep well-known political prisoners in jail for a long time. So instead, the kind of violation that's taking place is shooting at demonstrators, using lethal force instead of tear gas, for example, in demonstrations, and using force against political opponents in a situation where the military can try to excuse themselves on the grounds that this was mob violence or they were provoked by demonstrators or any other excuse they would choose to use. The only places where you have huge numbers of political prisoners of the kind of old-style human rights situation is certainly in Burma, certainly in China, to some extent in Vietnam, but not as many probably proportionally as in either Burma or China. And in most of the other countries, you're dealing with hundreds, not thousands, of political prisoners and other forms of human rights abuse towards these people.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Sydney Jones is the executive director of the human rights group Asia Watch. Our talk was recorded earlier today before the announcement that phase two of the Cambodia peace process would proceed without the Khmer Rouge. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. After making super low-budget films for Roger Corman like Stripped to Kill and Dance of the Damned, Kat Shea and Andy Rubin have made the new film Poison Ivy, which has been described both as laughable and brilliant. Actually, the Museum of Modern Art just had a retrospective of their films, and they've only been making films for about 6 years. Coming up, we talk with them about writing and directing Poison Ivy. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews two new comeback albums by performers he's glad have come back. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. White House spokesmen say that President Bush will maintain a hardline stance on compromises at the UN Earth Summit meeting in Rio. A campaign spokeswoman says the president should get good public support with his message that jobs are more important than foreign aid for the environment. Meanwhile, NPR's Richard Harris reports from Rio that diplomats at the summit are still working on some of those agreements.
Negotiators have already squared away a lot of the agreements that will be signed at the Earth Summit. They have settled the question of how money will be pledged and distributed, though not how much money. And there are agreements on ocean protection and technology sharing with the developing world. But diplomats say they expect to work late into the night to resolve the remaining issues. The most contentious is a non-binding statement of principles about the world's forests. Developing nations simply don't want the rest of the world to tell them what they can and cannot do with their forests. The negotiations must be complete by tomorrow, when more than 100 world leaders are to begin arriving at the Earth Summit. This is Richard Harris in Rio de Janeiro.
In Panama, police say a U.S. soldier was killed and another U.S. soldier was injured when gunmen fired on their jeep. Three gunmen opened fire on the military jeep with AK-47 assault rifles about 30 miles north of the capital of Panama. The soldier driving the jeep died of gunshot wounds, and a serviceman traveling with him was injured when the jeep overturned. The shooting occurred on the eve of a visit to Panama by President Bush. On Capitol Hill, the House has started debate on a balanced budget amendment on which both sides are predicting a close vote. A vote is slated tomorrow on the measure that the Bush administration has made an election year priority. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
House Speaker Tom Foley is leading the charge against the amendment, although he denies he's been doing any arm twisting. Foley says the amendment is a sham designed solely to give lawmakers political points at a time when voters are angry about the deficit and Congress's inability to reverse the recession. Supporters of the measure say it will force fiscal responsibility on the budget, which is expected to reach a record $350 billion in deficit this year. But some members say the measure will not make it any less difficult to raise taxes or cut programs. In a taped address today, President Bush called for passage of the measure. He said the deficit is real, congressional inaction is real, and a constitutional amendment mandating a balanced budget is what's needed. House Budget Committee Chairman Leon Panetta says he has no faith in the amendment. If the Constitution doesn't work, what then, Panetta asked, should we go and ask for a papal edict? I'm Elizabeth Arnold in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down nearly 27 points to close at 3,343.22 on volume of 207 million shares. This is NPR News. Republican Senator Richard Lugar says in order to get a ceasefire in Yugoslavia, there has to be a creditable threat to the use of force. The senator, a senior member of the Foreign Relations Committee, says that unrest in the country has gone far past the point where either economic sanctions or UN observers alone can be effective. He says that the Bush administration should take the lead in urging NATO to draw up military plans and the UN to authorize the use of force, and then give warring factions the choice to stop fighting or face military intervention. Police groups in Texas are calling for a boycott of a record company whose rap song describes a person contemplating killing a police officer. NPR's John Burnett reports.
The song by the Los Angeles rapper Ice-T is titled Cop Killer. The lyrics say, in part, I got my 12-gauge sawed off, I got my headlights turned off, I'm about to bust some shots off. I'm about to dust some cops off. Police officers in Texas are outraged because they think the song encourages people to ambush the police at traffic stops. Beginning with the Dallas Police Association, law enforcement groups across the state have called for a boycott of Warner Brothers Records and its parent, Time Warner Inc. A Time Warner spokesman says the company is committed to free expression and it has no plans to delete the song from future pressings of the album, which was released in March. Furthermore, he explained that the singer is merely role-playing the part of a youth angry at police abuse rather than advocating the killing of police. I'm John Burnett reporting.
In Czechoslovakia, President Havel is under new pressure after a call by a leading opposition party for him to step down. However, Havel says that he will run for office again as he looks for new ways to hold the nation together. The country was thrown into a political crisis after elections last week. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. When the Museum of Modern Art ran a retrospective earlier this spring of the films of Kat Shea and Andy Rubin, no one was more surprised than the filmmakers. After all, they made low-budget genre films for Roger Corman, like Stripped to Kill and Dance of the Damned. Their new movie, Poison Ivy, might give you an idea of the potential the museum saw in their earlier work. Poison Ivy was written by Shea and Rubin. She also directed the film. He produced it. Poison Ivy star Sarah Gilbert from TV's Roseanne, who plays Coop, an alienated teenager who finally finds a friend, a sluttish girl she nicknames Ivy, played by Drew Barrymore. Ivy has no parents. Coop invites her home. Ivy moves in. She sees each person's needs and vulnerabilities and knows just how to manipulate them to get what she wants. By the time the story ends, she's destroyed the family. In this scene, Ivy meets Coop's mother, who is dying of emphysema. Ivy picks up a photo of the mother as a young woman standing next to a convertible.
I bet you drove it with the top down even in the rain. I hope that when I die, I'll have owned a sports car, had a family, a home. My mom died an old lady who never did anything with the top down. One day with the top down is better than a lifetime in a box.
Have either of you ever had something in your life happen similar to this movie where a stranger comes in who kind of seduces everybody and then destroys everything around her?
Absolutely.
I'm going to let Andy take that question since he said absolutely. Well, go right ahead.
Well, I'm going to do the best I can. Everything that we write about is based on real people, and a lot of our dialogue is absolutely inspired by real things that we've heard. And once when I was like driving around at 3 a.m. on Hollywood Boulevard, which I do just to relax, there was a pregnant 15-year-old hooker on the side of the street. So I, of course, brought her home. What else do you do? And she basically went through that whole scene.
Yeah, what else do you do? Of course.
Yeah, what else can you do? And in fact, a lot of the words that she said inspired us for Ivy's character. Very, 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 very
much. The thing that people might be missing is that Andy brought her home to me and expected me to do something. So it was interesting. This young girl came and sat at the end of my bed and read me poetry.
All night long.
And told me how lucky I was to have the life that I have. So, yeah, that... you know, those little things make their way into your scripts.
What did she destroy?
What did she destroy, Andy?
Well, that's fictional. She didn't destroy anything. In fact, she joined AA, and we supported her and gave her rides, and she had a baby.
Mm-hmm. She was a little manipulative, but not to the extent that Ivy was.
Mm-hmm. There's a scene where the Drew Barrymore character, the Ivy character, seduces the father, played by Tom Skerritt. And then there's another scene as well where they do the forbidden act. And there really is the charge of the forbidden in the way you've shot the movie. You see the desire and the torment on the face of Tom Skerritt. Can you talk a little bit about directing that scene?
That the Daryl character that Tom Skerritt plays is so tortured. He's losing his job. His wife is dying, his young, beautiful wife that he expected to live way beyond him. He's estranged from his daughter. I mean, he's really got some serious problems. And in comes this beautiful young girl who is so similar to his wife in so many ways. And it really is a torture experience for him, trying not to feel the feelings that he has. And her being so manipulative and so in control, that's something that we've certainly seen in people. The character that Andy was talking about, this girl that he brought home, was a master manipulator.
You know, but a lot of that is beyond, you know, their own thoughts. They're being driven by their, you know, inner demons,
right?
And they're not aware of it.
Yeah. Certainly Ivy's driven by inner demons that she's not aware of to fulfill needs that she has to be taken care of and to get security and things like that. And there she is fulfilling these needs for this guy who is, you know, completely out of control. So that scene really is,
you know, I would just like to say that when we wrote it, you know, the most important thing was it for it not to be sexy, mm-hmm. for it to be sad. And that's why I think it's such a powerful scene, the way that Kat mm-hmm. shot it.
Mm-hmm. Also, I mean, I did shoot it from the point of view of those characters involved in it, and that's what it is, the heightened reality. You know, she's in these heels, and she steps on the glass, and the glass cracks in a way that is super real. And that's because that's where their senses are at that moment. Their senses are heightened in every way.
My guests are Kat Shea and Andy Rubin, who made the new film Poison Ivy. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Kat Shea and Andy Rubin. They co-wrote the new film Poison Ivy. She also directed it. He produced it. Tell us a story of how you both met and started working together.
Well, we met long before we started working together.
But how we started working together is you were acting in the Philippines.
Right. We were married at the time, and we're not married now. Now we're partners.
Now we're partners. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. We have a much better relationship now.
Infinitely better.
But anyway, Andy was in the Philippines with me, and I was acting in a movie, and I was playing the girl part, you know?
And boy, was I bored.
I don't write these kind of parts. We don't write these kind of parts. Andy certainly doesn't write these kind of parts. He writes the best women, by the way. I just have to say.
I'm the feminist in the
Andy
group.
Writes women that are fantastic. But I was playing one of those empty and meaningless girl parts in an action movie, and I was very bored.
So I said, let's write a movie about a girl who really is super and does absolutely everything. Mm-hmm. And we actually wrote this script.
Right.
And that script didn't get made, but it got us a job. And we wrote a movie called, what was that movie called? What was the movie that got made that we wrote?
Oh, The Patriot. That was awful.
Well, anyway, they so butchered our script that was not bad at all. That we said, from now on, we're going to make the whole thing ourselves. Right. You direct, I'll produce, and we'll both write them.
Right.
You wrote a screenplay together called Strip to Kill that Roger Corman executive produced or whatever. This is, if I have it straight, about a man killer hiding out as a stripper and a woman cop who goes undercover in a strip joint to find him. How did you come up with the story?
Well,
we were really inspired by
famous bet. Driving back from Palm Springs, we had a bet that mussels mm-hmm. were poisonous during part of the year.
Andy said they were poisonous, and I said they weren't.
Of course I won.
Of course.
And the bet was Kat had to go to a strip club if I won.
He wanted to totally humiliate me.
So we went to a strip club, and I got bored in 15 minutes, and Kat said, no, let's stay. There's something happening here. It's great.
Oh, I was blown away by them.
What?
I mean, I just felt that they were really artists who uh-huh. were frustrated artists, and they were working out their art in this strip club, and I thought it was just incredible. I really appreciated them.
So we
walked out, and I said, you know, Andy, we got to make a movie about this. I never knew this existed. See, I stood outside this strip club a half an hour before I would go through the door because I thought that I was going to witness women really...
being
humiliated. And I didn't want to see that. And I got in this place, and I was just... I was mesmerized.
We should also point out it's one of the last strip clubs left where the women actually do acts
right.
and have routines.
It was burlesque.
Yeah, it was beautiful.
Now, before you started to make movies together, Kat, you were an actress, and Andy, you were writing for TV, including for the series CPO Sharky, which I don't think I ever saw, but also Love
you
Boat,
and,
right? Love
you Boat? And 100 million other
yeah.
people didn't
right.
say it.
And you wrote for Love Boat?
So one episode.
Just one? Here's what
just
I really wanted
episode.
To know. I mean, you know, that was one of those series where, like, every week there was a different washed-up guest actor, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, so mm-hmm. did you know in advance who, like, the washed-up actor of the week was going to be and write for no. them?
I thought I did know. Didn't I know?
Did you know it was Donald O'Connor?
I don't know. Did I know? You know, my memory.
Andy wrote a Love Boat where Donald O'Connor falls in love with a seal.
It's actually a Love Boat. It's actually a script I'm very proud of to this day. When I see it on television,
it's really
I'm very
an unusual
happy.
Love Boat. It's not the kind.
You know, he has to choose.
You know,
he has to choose between his love for his seal and his love for a woman.
Right.
And in the end, he chooses both of them. But after the seal tries to commit suicide and
always
things like
the
that.
Bizarre.
Yeah. But I'm very proud of that.
And Kat, you had been acting in such films as Preppies, Barbarian Queen, Psycho 3. What kinds of parts were you getting?
How did you get that information is what I want to know.
An old Variety article.
Oh, damn.
There was headline something of like thespian to helmsman, you know?
Well, you know, we all have to make a living.
Right, absolutely.
It's the only thing I have to say about it, really. You know,
well, that's why Kat's a filmmaker.
I feel
now.
Very proud of the fact that I've written some wonderful roles for women. That Andy and I have written wonderful roles for women because when I was acting, I never had a wonderful role.
What were your roles like? Embarrassing, humiliating?
Yes.
Yeah. I would say so. I mean, I'm not.
I thought you were pretty good in them, though.
I mean, you know, I'm proud of the fact that I did what I did because it wasn't easy, you know, to be an actress at 25 years old in competition with 10 million other 25-year-old actresses and to work. And I'm proud of the fact that I was able to do that.
And there's a lot of experiences that you gain acting.
I really learned from it. Mm-hmm. I mean, I learned what not to do. From very bad directors. And, you know, sometimes playing those parts was really humiliating. I'll give you that. It was difficult to say those lines and do those things because it was bad stuff. I mean, it was D-movie stuff. But I learned a tremendous amount being on those sets, and I was open to it.
Mm-hmm. You had been married for, I think, over a decade. And now you're separated, but you're still planning to work together.
We're divorced, yes. Actually. Yeah, we are going to work together. She's the most talented person that I can even imagine.
I feel the same way about Andy, you know. I mean, I would never want to do anything that would disrupt our partnership.
Do you know what your next movie is going to be?
A little mutual admiration society here. Yeah.
I thought.
Oh,
I
what's
it.
Our next thing? Is our next thing? We don't
we
know
like
yet.
This, we like this motorcycle picture.
Yeah, I do. I love this. It's a biker movie. She asks about genre, and we say, oh, no, not genre. But
here's a biker movie.
But here
movie
we like this biker movie.
But it's really
about it's transformation really a metaphor, of yeah. spirit, honestly. Yeah. It truly is. It's about this guy's... transformation. It
well,
just
I believe
to
you.
Take
I mean,
place.
I do believe yeah. you. Having
just
seen
it happens
Ivy.
To take
yeah.
place on a Harley.
See, and I thought you were going to say it's you? About the transportation of spirit.
The transfer.
That too.
That's good.
It's about the transportation of spirit and the transformation of spirit.
And there's a lot of motorcycles, so it's cool.
Yeah.
Well, good luck, and thanks a lot for talking with us.
Thank you.
Kat Shea and Andy Rubin made the new film Poison Ivy. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah Adams is with us. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. Senator Richard Lugar is talking about drawing the line in Bosnia-Herzegovina, talking about an ultimatum and possible military action, blaming Serbia for the continuous shelling of Sarajevo. Elizabeth Arnold reports on efforts by Bill Clinton to win back or win over the confidence of Democrats. I'll talk with the director of Costa Rica's Biodiversity Institute, about the Merck Pharmaceutical Company's contract with Costa Rica. The country supplies 10,000 samples of plants and insects. Merck tries to find a new wonder drug. Costa Rica would share in the royalties. It's an example of chemical prospecting.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Singers Ann Peebles and Otis Clay made their reputations in the early 70s with soul music successes. Clay on the R&B charts with songs like That's How It Is and I'm Satisfied. Peebles with the big pop hit I Can't Stand the Rain. Both of these singers have just released new albums, and rock critic Ken Tucker says they're more than just good comeback attempts. Here's Peebles.
Bye.
It's a cinch that Ann Peebles and Otis Clay are aware of a fundamental pop culture truism, that artists do their best, most innovative work early on in their careers, and then spend the rest of their creative lives working variations on it, that is, repeating themselves. The trick to a long-lasting career is to make those repetitions seem fresh and lively. Ann Peebles addresses this point more or less specifically on the cut I just played, Bouncin' Back, while Otis Clay does it more indirectly on I Can Take You to Heaven Tonight.
Someone like you should never have a sad face. And I can't imagine who would ever cause your heart to break. But if you let me have some time, I'll take this trouble, take it off your mind. Now I can't perform miracles, but if you let me, I'll try. See, I'm no angel, but I can take you to heaven tonight. I can take you to heaven tonight.
heaven tonight. I know it, but you know I'll treat you right.
Otis Clay's new album is called I'll Treat You Right. Ann Peebles is Part-Time Love. They're both on a subsidiary of Boston's Rounder Records called Bullseye Blues. 2 decades ago, Peebles and Clay shared a different record label, High Records, the Memphis company that brought us, most famously, Al Green. High Records was legendary for its rhythm section. It was a tight yet fluid group that included Howard Grimes on drums, Leroy Flick Hodges on bass, and Leroy's brother Charles on organ and piano. That high rhythm section has been reunited for these new recordings, and you can hear them stretch out on Ann Peebles' Read Me My Rights.
I'm just a prisoner, caught up in this world I can't control. What am I doing here? Just drive.
Although they share a certain gravelly tone, Peebles and Clay are very different sorts of singers. Peebles has always favored a blunt, assertive tone. She declaims her lyrics in a conversational manner. Clay, on the other hand, came up through gospel music and incorporates a spiritual cry and moan in many of his best songs. Where Peebles often expresses righteous anger, Clay describes a heartbreaking fatalism. It's unlikely that either of their new albums is going to be a big hit. As commercial stylists, their time is past. But that doesn't mean that these aren't vital records made by singers whose sense of history hasn't muffled them in nostalgia. If you're looking for classic soul music that hasn't been co-opted for use in a beer or car commercial, here's just about the best stuff around.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Thad Kirk, Audrey Voblaitis, and Richard Parker. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross, and here's more from Otis Clay.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, composing music for a Russian circus. We talk with composer and drummer Bobby Previtt. His latest album features his ensemble playing the circus music he was commissioned to write. By the way, he was rehearsing with the circus in Moscow during the attempted coup. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.